Every day I'm hustling. 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 Every day I'm. Every day I'm hustling.
Okay, so I am here with Maggie Anderson, who is most recently the author of Our Black Year. Maggie, how are you doing?
I'm doing great today. How are you guys?
Doing all right. I just want to go ahead and start off. You are responsible for a rather amazing idea called the Empowerment Experiment, which you document in this book, in which you spent the entire year buying nothing but black-owned businesses, frequenting them and so forth. Just to sort of get the ball rolling here, I want to kind of try to discuss why this is necessary. You point out in the book that there were 6,339 African-American-owned and or operated grocery stores in the United States in the early decades of the 20th century. And then by the time we get to the new millennium, only 19 African-American-owned grocery stores existed in the U.S. So I'm curious, for a number of questions come to mind. First of all, what specific figures are you relying on? Is this from the 2002 economic census? What ultimately accounts for this dramatic decline?
Well, the numbers are so important to us, and I hope you, we gotta let your listeners know that we fashioned this as an experiment. It was, of course, a stand.
Yeah.
But we really wanted these important numbers to get injected into the national dialogue. Those numbers, how we used to have so many businesses in the country, in our community. We had hotel chains, department stores, hardware stores, drug stores. We don't have any of that now, grocery stores. And that when we had those businesses, our community didn't suffer. We didn't have the high unemployment. Our kids weren't choosing gangs over college. We didn't have all this drug abuse and violence and recidivism. So we really wanted to bear out that correlation, that when we had strong black-owned businesses, our community didn't suffer. So if we can find a way to do little things to bring some of those businesses back, maybe we can counter the social crises that disproportionately impact our community. We wanted to show the numbers. The big number that we wanted to talk about was our $1 trillion in buying power, and that less than 6% of that makes its way back to the black community.
Yes.
If we can just get a little bit more of our own buying power to be recycled in our own communities, maybe we can bring those jobs numbers up. The other number is that black businesses are by far the greatest private employer of black people.
Yeah.
Black unemployment, we know, is 3 times the national average of our white counterparts, highest among any ethnic group. And in some places like Birmingham and Cleveland, we're at black unemployment like 50 and 60%. So maybe if we start supporting more black businesses that employ black people, we can stop black unemployment. So it was really just about making sure the conversation about the black situation in America is thorough and comprehensive. We can't just keep talking about black unemployment and then not talking about black buying power and the fact that black businesses employ black people and that none of our buying power is going to black businesses. So the numbers that we depended on, to get back to your question, you know, it's just kind of known in our community how we don't support each other, how if you walk up and down the street in a black neighborhood, none of the businesses there are black owned except for the funeral parlors, mm-hmm. the barbershops, and the braid salons. It's just kind of known how, you know, none of most of the products on the shelves, none of the retailers in our community, none of the franchises are black. So we just kind of know that, we joke about it, it hurts, but you know, we just accept it. But it was so hard to find data to bear that out. You know,
yeah.
We make jokes about it. But we did find an interesting study. I think it was an economist, John Ray, who did a study based out of D.C. that proved this horrible statistic about how long the dollar lives in different ethnic communities. And this is a kind of this statistic is used a lot in this conversation where people talk about leakage, economic leakage, recycling wealth and in minority communities, that kind of stuff. This is a well-known statistic that in the Asian community, the dollar lives for like close to 28 days. in the Jewish community, I think it was like 19 to 21 days, Hispanic community, 7 days. But for Black people, the dollar in the Black community lasts 6 hours.
Yeah.
And it's like, no wonder we live at the bottom. So our whole, we're just so frustrated that no one talks about that 6 hours. Because if you don't talk about the 6 hours, then you're basically saying that all of these horrible things happening in the Black community is a reflection of our propensity and our potential, not a byproduct of how there's a lack of support from Black consumers. It's our fault for Black businesses. So sorry about the long way.
Oh, no, no, that's that. And there's
leave that out with such an open
I know. No, no, this is all very good. And there's a load of threads to start from here. But actually, I'm sure you're familiar. There was a study in 2010, a rather alarming economic study from the Oakland-based Insight Center for Community Economic Development, which revealed that the median wealth of a single white woman in the prime of their working years, roughly like 35 to 49, was $42,600. And the median wealth for a single Black woman was only $5. You know,
yeah,
I'm sure you're familiar. And then, of course, if you're a married...
I'm onto that one in time. I heard about that. And that just, man, the one that really blows me away is that there's the other one about, I think we're at 3% transferable wealth or whatever the definition of wealth, but 3% compared to the white counterparts. But that thing about the single Black woman, I mean, it's just... That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been here 400 years. We have a Black president now. We have folks like me.
Yes.
We have living manifestations of the American dream at work. You know that my family's an immigrant family.
Yes.
You know, we have all of this and we still have that. And, you know, it's going to be hard to bring that kind of number, to make that number a fairer number. It's going to be really hard. But at least if everyday consumers like me or to try to find the businesses that are going to employ that woman, give her a fair wage, or give her community a chance, invest in her community instead of just making money from that community and taking it away, maybe we can do something about that number.
Well, and the statistics actually get slightly better when you account for marriage or cohabitation. The white woman has a median wealth of $167,500, and the Black woman has $31,500. So, better than $5, but still really troubling. I guess the question I have, since we're talking about the idea of a Black dollar not going so far, what do you all think ultimately accounts for this failure to have the wealth reinvested in the community on in Black neighborhoods? How can they be expected to invest their wealth in any concentrated manner? I mean, what are the underlying issues here? I'm curious.
Right, right. And it's so funny because, you know, when people, you just hear about the essence of our experiment.
Yeah.
You know, Black family says they're only going to support Black businesses. You know, there's this, you know, there's accusations of racism, if you will. And
yeah.
We'll assume that the book is like, you know, this thing of taking it to the man and getting back at Charlie and all that kind of stuff.
Getting back at Charlie, huh?
The white man, Charlie, in the 70s. But anyway, and but this, the book is really, if I'm yelling at anyone, it's at Black consumers. Because when, you know, there's a lot of history here that contributes to the bad situation we're in. I'll be real quick. A lot of it has to do with integration. Of course, we love what integration did for this country. Of course, we fought for it. But it had some real negative impacts, some deleterious impacts into the Black economy, if you will. Because we're forced to, because we're segregated, we built up our own businesses. We had this strong sense of entrepreneurship in our community, and we recycled our wealth. So that was just the fact. That's the way it was. And we, I think University of Wisconsin just did a study that showed in 2009 where there was like over 50% Black unemployment in Milwaukee, in the same area where there used to be Black businesses flourishing in the 1950s before integration, there was less than 7% unemployment. So it really bears out that when we had the businesses, the Black people were employed. So after integration, we were so anxious to be enfranchised. We were just so happy to have that opportunity to shop at Woolworth, to go to Walgreens, that we did it in droves. And it was just kind of our way of saying, yeah, we're going to show you our money is just as good as white people's money, and we're going to show you how important we are and how equal we are by spending as much money with you as we can. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, we kind of abandoned our would-be Woolworths. You know, we're already providing quality goods and services in the community. All of our consumers just left those local black businesses that helped our community shine to go after these big corporations where we denied the right to shop before. So that was the first punch. And then the second punch came in because these corporations started to see the value of the black consumer dollar. So they started to market to us very positively. Another term that I'll bring up that's, you know, kind of funny is we used to say colored on.
Yeah.
Colored on. We were so excited if GM were to show a black family coming out of a house driving their Cadillac to the family vacation, or McDonald's were to have a black family enjoying a family meal or something like that. We're so happy when we saw that was the best way for them to market to us, and we returned that honor with our dollar, with our loyalty. So that was the second punch. They started marketing to us more aggressively, and we started to spend more money with them and not our businesses. Then the third punch was they started to recruit us. So yeah. When I was coming up, I'm 40, so like in the 70s, when I was coming up, the big deal for black mothers, for black parents, for black grandparents, was for me, that kind of shiny star, that smart kid that hoped to get out of the ghetto, is for me to find a great job at a big white company.
Yeah.
That was the goal. It wasn't like with our Asian counterparts, even our Hispanic counterparts, to continue in the family business, to start a business, to stay in the community. No, it wasn't that. It was get out and do so by getting that great job. So the would-be entrepreneurs, our talented 10th, if you remember that from
yes.
the book, we didn't do our talented 10th duty. We left the community and we gave all our talent to big corporations. All of these things contributed to the lack of support for black business and our lack of that kind of sense of entrepreneurship in the community. The big deal is to get a good job, not be an entrepreneur. So the entrepreneurs we do have don't have the capital or the training to compete. So, you know, we can only survive in those industries where no one else can do it better, you know, and that's in braiding hair, cutting black hair, and providing funeral services in our community. So that's where we can still have a stronghold, even in black hair,
yeah,
in beauty supplies, even in all that kind of stuff. We've lost those industries. That was kind of the fourth punch when immigrant groups basically started to leverage this wonderful phenomenon of a whole class of people that loves to spend money outside of their community, and they set up shop in our communities. Not racist, not trying to steal our wealth, but set up shop there and did well there, and now we're upset because we can't find quality black businesses in our own neighborhoods when basically we invited the intrusion by not supporting the black businesses we did have. So all of this is led to the demise that we have now. So some of it, yes, some of our racist history, a lot of it has to do with our consumers, our people, kind of seeing our own businesses in a negative way. It's a real difficult thing to talk about outside of the black community. It's just kind of cultural, but the definition is another term, white man's ice is colder.
Sure.
Why go to a black business when you can go to a white business? The way we show that we're equal is by buying Polo, buying Hennessy, by living in white suburbs. That's how we demonstrate our equality, not by buying black products and supporting local black businesses. I know it's kind of a disgusting thing to say, but
yeah,
that's the truth.
Well, I mean, as an effort to unpack much of what you've just said, for example, in this book, among the businesses that you include in the empowerment experiment are, for example, a black-owned Quiznos. But my understanding, of course, is that a white guy named Rich Shaden is the principal shareholder, and that he and his company have this history of ripping off numerous franchise holders. I'm sure you're familiar with the Quiznos franchise holder, Bhupender Babur. He killed himself over this. So, yes, I agree that a black-owned Quiznos, it may indeed hire more black employees, but if the parent company is exploiting its franchise owners, I'm wondering if this cycle of exploitation has a negative impact on a black neighborhood or a black community? Shouldn't one also consider the independent nature of a business as well? How does a black-owned Quiznos help a community more than, say, an independent family restaurant?
Right, and this is a huge point that I have to contend with.
Yeah.
When I push this kind of supplier diversity, franchisee diversity message into the community, and here's how it goes when I'm talking to black folk who I'm trying to get to support black businesses, which it should not be that tough of a fight, but it is.
Yeah.
When I say this to them, you know, they come at me with legitimate stuff like this. Well, when we tried to go to Kareem's grocery store, he didn't have everything we wanted, or it wasn't like going to our Jewel grocery store, the big grocery chain out here. Or, you know, you can go to this black franchise, but I can see a bunch of black employees there. Or how do I know Quiznos is a good franchise to be supported? So I get legitimate challenges. Then I say, well, you know what? How was that? I mean, what are you doing now? You know, basically, we're just out there supporting anybody, not thinking about what this business is doing for us. Polo. I mean, Polo lives off black consumer. We have black Polo parties.
Yeah.
When we have our kids. I mean, it's ridiculous how addicted we are to the Polo brand. I have nothing against Polo Rappaport, but I did have a friend who works right at the CFO for Polo, and I asked her to do some research for me. She's, you know, a conscious consumer like me, HBS grad, very well connected in the company, and she did an exhaustive search, talked to the marketing folks, the procurement folks, everybody, about supplier diversity. Do you do business? How do you invest in the black community when we have so much money coming from the black community? And their answer to me was, well, our labor comes out of Mopesha. And it's like, unbelievable. That's the best you can do to reciprocate the loyalty that the black consumer, that the black community is giving you. So it's like, yeah, okay, maybe, and you're totally right about the Quiznos thing.
Yeah.
But first answer to them is, but you're supporting Polo. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you're stopping in supporting Polo. And I'm not saying don't support Polo, but if you're so discriminating with how you spend your money, there's a lot of things that we shouldn't be doing that we're already doing. The second thing is, I have to fight for this supplier diversity thing, not because I like it, not because I would have preferred that we had maybe some great black sandwich shops, dependents in the community that we're supporting. But with the fight that I have in my community to get black consumer to support us, that's the best I can do. I got to give them the low-hanging fruit. Okay, I know you're not going to support that black sandwich shop. I know you're not going to go to the West Side like I do every week to go to my bank, to go to the party supply store to get stuff for my kids. I know you're not going to drive like I do to find that one black-owned Popeye's whose owner I know and is this great guy. I know you're not going to go to the West Side because they have a new black-owned movie theater there. And that's where I take my family the few times we get to go to the movies. I know you're not going to do that, but I know you've been to Quiznos. So at least go to black-owned Quiznos. That's kind of where I am now. I'm just, you know, it's kind of less of the evils. It's like, I know you're not going to the black sandwich shop, so go to Quiznos, go to the black subway because they have gift cards. And if you go to the black-owned one, maybe you can buy a gift card there and help that as well. So it's not a great answer, but the challenge I'm facing, I'm just happy if consumers do a little bit to support a few black businesses that we do.
Sure. I mean, but what ultimately distinguishes a black-owned business from an independent business? Perhaps what we're really talking about is trying to find some fusion of the two ideals so that multiple problems here can be solved. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right. So that, you know what, it would be wonderful if this could morph into, evolve into, if it could have started off as a buy local kind of thing. Because that's really what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
We wanted to spend a little less money in Oak Park that doesn't really need it. Our affluent suburb with the perfectly funded school systems and a park on every corner and, you know, clean streets. We wanted to spend a little more of our money in the West Side that needs our money. And we care about the West Side. And it started off that we were just looking for businesses in the West Side that could support. And that's when we found out that most of the businesses in the West Side aren't even owned by people who are there and aren't employing the people that are there. So I wish it could be simple as buy local, and I wish that those strong independents like Kareem Bia and his grocery store, gosh, he was perfect, and we did everything to grow, to blow him up.
I know.
And he could survive. So it's just, I started off as an optimist, but I'm a realist now about this. If I put my energy into trying to get Kareem to do this again, or trying to get some guy, the guy who Bronzeville Coffee Shop, where John would meet all his clients, go to the Bronzeville Shop, part of the South Side, great local owner who cared about the community, he's dead now. Yeah. Most of the businesses that we try to support, those independent, local, great, we call them EE entrepreneurs, they're dead. So it's that dependent thing, while it is the ideal, I do live it and practice it in my life. When I'm pushing the message out and I'm trying to get folks to at least get started and thinking about where their money goes, it's just such a tougher sell. It's just easier for them to say, okay, well, I can go to a black-owned McDonald's. I'm not going to go to a black sandwich fast food franchise like Quench, this great fast food franchise, 8 locations, black-owned. Great entrepreneur, great guy, food, but folks aren't going to Quench. They just closed one of their locations that I used to go to, but they'll go to McDonald's. So I know it's not the right answer. And then the other piece of it is, yeah, it's tough pushing, hey, let's support black businesses, when, to be honest, a lot of these guys aren't necessarily investing in serve black neighborhoods, employing black people. It's tough to make this claim that supporting black businesses is going to grow the black community when not every black entrepreneur is doing what he is charged to do in the talented tenth doctrine, and that's employ the chronically unemployed and be a role model for those kids. The best answer for that is they are the most inclined, and the businesses that I have supporting, they are those great entrepreneurs that really, really need to be supported. And I can't be soft on this. If I let this go and just say buy local, a lot of businesses, a lot of my Tracy Hintons and those guys you saw in the book are not supported. I need folks to go out there and seek those businesses that I found and support them, because they're the answer. We're not going to get a perfect solution every time. I go to this great restaurant in downtown. It's a black restaurant, real fancy, and I tell people to go there because I know that this place is just as nice as any Houston, or I'm trying to think of a really nice restaurant as a chain. Really, really nice place. Folks go there easy. But you know what? The last time I went there, I didn't see one black employee.
Yeah.
I was like, are you kidding me? You can't find black waiters and cooks? And it was really sad to see that. Thriving, they're doing well. A lot of black customers in there, a lot of white customers in there. Just a great example of a great black entrepreneur doing well. But he needs one more to employ some folks, especially when our unemployment is so high, especially in that kind of industry where he can find labor. But, you know, I'm doing the best I can. I'm not giving you the perfect answer, but...
Oh, no, no. I totally understand. These are very complicated issues. In fact...
It's very complicated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one aspect of this that we are sort of dancing around, but we've mentioned a couple of times, are class divisions within the black community. During the course of your experiment, in fact, you were forced to confront your own perceptions, such as the man who was selling food stamps for cash, to whom you shouted, "Do you think I'm going to give you my money so that you can go out and get drunk? How stupid do I look?" And then you have this angry guy inside when you're trying to use your gas card, and he helps you bag groceries. So here's the question. If there's so much seething anger that blacks on every class level are feeling for each other, isn't the question rooted more in economy rather than race? Or how does this work? Aren't we really talking more about, I suppose, buying indie over buying chain? How do you answer these questions?
Okay, I see what you're saying now, a little clearer. And, you know, I was talking about this with someone the other day. Eugene Robinson, you know, at the Post, real popular journalist.
Yeah.
Who kind of talks about these issues. He talks about the class stuff. And he's one of those guys that say, and I agree with him, that a lot of the black issues we're confronting now have much more to do with class than race.
Yeah.
And it's not a great joke, but it's something that we kind of laugh about a lot when we're the only chocolate chips at a fancy restaurant or when we're the only black people at a big corporate gathering or something like that. Where we say, you know what, we have a lot more in common with these guys than we do our black brothers and sisters on the west side or the south side, the communities we come from. And that is a cause of a lot of problems that's going on in my community. It's, you know, whatever on it in corporate America or outside the country, whenever we got together and we were unified and we loved and respected each other, things better. Everything that's gained in this country, coming out of slavery, being with Jim Crow, getting enfranchised, came because all of us worked together to be unified, to express solidarity, and we don't have that anymore because that gap, that expanse between the middle class and upper class folks like John and I, and those folks in the ghetto is getting bigger and bigger. And that has nothing to do with what folks outside the community are doing to us or anything like that. It's that we're running away from our community. And that's a tough pill to swallow because a lot of folks like me, we kind of just assume that all of that marching, dying, and lynching was so that I can have this nice house and buy nice things.
Yeah.
And so I'm buying the nice house, I'm buying the nice thing, and I'm negating stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
That's my job, so that I can go to that nice restaurant, and even though there's negative stereotypes being perpetuated in the media or in the movies, you have me. I'm a great, productive, suburban mom, smart. I'm a perfect example of what the black community can be, or black community's promise. But that's not enough. I can't just go around saying, because I can buy a nice car, I'm doing my part to lift up my community. And it's that dichotomy. My saying I'm a proud African American, but not doing anything in my daily life to help the African American community, that the real source of the problems that we have, and that within the African-American context is totally economic and helps create this racially divided economy that we're trying to show truly exists. It is different for black consumers, it is different for black businesses, but a lot of that has to do with black middle class and upper class folks not becoming business people, because maybe if I were to use some of my talent and smarts to be an entrepreneur, I could be a successful one with the networks, connections I have, and the education that I have.
Sure.
That's number one. And maybe if more of my consumers were supporting the Kareems out there, and we didn't, and we don't, maybe Kareem could be on his fifth store by now and brokering deals with Dominix and American food stores the way Magic Johnson's been able to do.
Sure.
So that is all folks fun. That has economics, and you're right. I'm not sure if I did it well enough in the book. I need you to know now that I absolutely do believe that the class relations we have within the black community are probably the main reason that we have these economic disparities and divisions that we have in the American economy.
Sure. Well, I mean, the other issue here, the thing that sort of made me aware especially of class, is that the total year-end cost for the empowerment experiment for your purchases was $48,943.89. I had just mentioned to you that the median wealth of a single white woman in the prime of her working years was $42,600. So that's a good deal more than many working-class blacks can afford or even live on.
We could have
Yeah.
stuff we wanted.
Exactly. So,
oh, yeah.
I mean, the question, though, if the cost of buying black is limited to the middle class or the upper class, how can someone who is pinching pennies be part of this experiment? Even if someone decides to buy black even a little bit, is this really enough to tip the balance? We were talking earlier about citing all these figures that it's really a considerable problem. I mean, even if you support a black business, even piecemeal, it may not necessarily be enough to account for the ongoing race-based business disparity. So what of these issues?
You're right about that. My answer to that is I really do focus, and it could be for my personal reasons, but we really do focus on the middle class and upper class folks. Number one, we do have a lot more money than the poor people. Number two, we haven't lived up our duty to try to do something about the economic situations that keep these people poor and uneducated and the communities not self-sustaining. So that's number two, we haven't lived up to our duty. And number three, we are the absolute worst. We bring that 2% to fruition. When I'm in the community and I'm talking to community folks who live in the south side of Chicago and live in Oakland, a lot of these guys really do try to support black businesses. A lot of their friends own that fried chicken shack, that local black-owned car wash, that barber shop. These guys do subscribe to the Chicago Defender. Something that, you know, that folks like John and I do now, but folks like John and I would never even consider doing.
So
these folks are putting their money in those local community banks because sometimes they don't even have a large national bank chain in their community. So if they don't go to the check cashers, the only option is that local black-owned community bank. So the poor folks, I'd say their number is probably more like 25% going back of their small income going back into the black community. But folks like me who throw our money into the Targets and the Kmarts and the JCPenney's and try our best to shop downtown and in our affluent suburbs, we're the cause of that 2%. The fact that the 2% of the $1 trillion is going back to the black community. So I'm really focused on us to try to get more of us. If the impact would just be phenomenal, we could just get our 2% to 10%. If we'd just get, I think what the study did, Northwestern folks, the Kellogg folks who did the study, they focused on those African American households with incomes of $75,000 or more. We isolated them and we showed that segment were to increase their spending from 2% to 10%. We could potentially create, I think it was close to 900,000 jobs in the black community just by our shifting our spending to businesses that already exist. So I'm not saying that we don't want, of course, the poor, lower class folks to participate in it. I think by and large a lot of them do already because they have choices, not because they're necessarily hyper supporting black businesses. Consumers like me have more choices. We can shop wherever we want, and that's really a reason that a lot of black people see us as heroes, because they know most folks like us wouldn't dare go back into struggling black communities for anything, and try our best. It's a badge of honor to not have to support black businesses the way poor black folks who live in neighborhoods do. So we're seen as heroes for taking this stand, and what we ask people to do is, okay, we don't want you to do everything that we do, or that we do the experiment, but if you can just do a little bit, like maybe go back to the community once a month and support that restaurant there, maybe subscribe to Chicago Defender, maybe put one of your accounts into that black bank, maybe drive it into the south side, get your car washed instead of just putting it at your local gas station, your suburb, you can get to that 10%. Easily, you can get to that 10%. Use more black professionals, you know, stuff like that. And so I focus on middle class and upper class folks because, first of all, we're the reason that our community suffers the way it does. It's not their fault. They're the byproduct. There's a residue, I say, of our ascendancy. So if anything, we need to be doing a lot more than poor folks who are struggling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the other hand, you do run the risk of possibly creating further divides among working class blacks and middle class blacks. I mean, let's discuss gentrification, for example. We've been sort of dancing around that issue as well. You get into gentrifying areas in Chicago, specifically Hyde Park and Bronzeville, writing, "The gentrification is not designed to preserve a neighborhood's racial and socioeconomic demographics, which is why I'm highly suspicious of it." Yet you also point out that blacks from the South Side and the West Side, they disregard each other because of class distinction. You also write, "If gentrification can also be used to improve the welfare of those who would be displaced, then I think it can help achieve glorious things." Well, I say to you, Maggie, if working class people can't afford these glorious things, or more affluent blacks are looking down at working class blacks, doesn't this get in the way of unity? How can you promote understanding, aside from this, you know, very commendable heroism among all blacks, that all need to benefit? I mean, we've been also talking about Farmer's Best Market. That didn't go over well. Radio ads, the Real Man Cook Chicago picnic. So where is the source of unity? Is unity something that you have to work on incrementally among classes, or what?
Right. You're absolutely right. And I actually had a talk with PBS NewsHour yesterday about really specifically about this. And the challenge he made it a little tougher than you did. I think you're being really nice to me today. Am I basically going to end up being just a big old ethnic cheerleader trying to fix stuff that can't be fixed, and with these really solid, palpable class issues in our community, cultural issues in our community? I mean, stuff that's just, I mean, will wear you out. There's just no real answer for, except from, you know, just within. Can we change the macro stuff? With, you know, with, I can churn out a bunch of studies and do a bunch of experiments and create a bunch of farmers' best, but if we don't fix the stuff that's going on inside and cure these tensions, then, or create the best gentrification model possible, a well-meaning gentrification model, and
but isn't gentrification all about well-meaning? That's the problem in the end, you know.
I can do all that, but am I just going to end up being an ethnic cheerleader?
Yeah.
And here's I guess the good news: the bigger this thing gets, the more I speak around the country. I don't want to make it this simple, but we are kind of opening eyes, and kind of, word is guilting, I guess I'll have to say it here.
Sure.
Some of our folks who do care, and a lot of them just don't think about it anymore. We're just kind of so busy planning the vacations and trying to preserve the equity in our houses and going to all the conferences and stuff that we just kind of don't think about that kind of stuff anymore.
Yeah.
Putting it in their faces a little bit, it is getting folks. The folks, there are, John and Maggie aren't alone. There are folks out there who do see this and want to do something. So to the extent that the Empowerment Experiment and Our Black Year are uniting those folks, I am very, very hopeful. The issue is that even with what I'm pushing, I don't think that those folks are going to go the extra step and really get into these communities and fix the problems. I can probably get them to spend a little more with some easily identifiable, easily accessible, already scrubbed black franchises and dealers. I can probably get them to do that and put some of their money in black banks. But to really get them to go into the South Side and fight for poor black people and be a part of those gentrification committees and make sure that the businesses that come into that community are employing there, and that we still preserve the local history and, you know, all that stuff that gentrification can do to get folks like me to be on those teams and give their time for that, I'm not as hopeful about that. But I'll give you one little nugget. If you remember in the book Mel Monroe, I don't think we're even on the same page, gentrification. Mel had that campy in the heart of Bronzeville. I don't know how much you know about Chicago, but he's on 46th Street in South Michigan. So it's a pretty tough part of town.
Yeah.
Mel started, and I'm on the board, and we got like 20 awesome, talented tenthers to come out the other night. And we created this board for this thing called Beacon. It's a new chamber. It's going to be a progressive chamber. We're not even calling it a black chamber.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a progressive chamber to kind of try to do that kind of perfect, idealistic gentrification model. Bring more outside folks through tourism into Bronzeville, show off a lot of the Bronzeville history, and kind of clean up Bronzeville without displacing the folks, but kind of give these folks jobs or hanging out in the corner, and the white folks who are coming to his B&B are not coming back because of some folks hanging out in the corner. Do something about those folks. Get some jobs or you know, get something. But just try to get more investment into Bronzeville by having more mills open up shop in Bronzeville and attracting more investment into Bronzeville through tourists. It's a pilot. We're going to see what happens. We've got folks from the police department, politicians, folks like me, folks like Mel, you know, on this board. It's a little thing, but we're trying to just see if we can bring Bronzeville back, bring some black businesses back like Mel's, and bring some money into Bronzeville without hurting the people there. And I think if these 20 folks were to do half of what they've committed to do in that meeting, then we can have a great example of what you just said. These folks spending time with the poor folks in Bronzeville and kind of through those interactions curing some of the tension there. And who knows?
Well, if we can, it's not just...
Hold them off.
Oh, sorry, but it's not just a matter of spending time or investing. It's a matter of making sure that the prices of groceries don't go up. It's a matter of making sure that the rent doesn't go up for a lot of people. That's ultimately what's going to anger most people and cause more strife. I mean, you know, discussions are great. Idealism is great. I'm a fairly optimistic person myself. I'm also a fairly realistic person. And the question is in all this discussion of gentrification, what we're really not talking about is this issue of rising price. You know, when a store has to, a store that actually offers affordable groceries has to be closed down for a shinier place that's going to offer a dollar per item more, that's going to have a huge effect on a person's pocketbook, especially if they're working two jobs, especially if they're also trying to hold on to their jobs and they're dealing with this influx of rising costs and so forth. So, I mean, I'm wondering, is there any sort of Venn diagram that could account for both rising costs and also black-owned businesses that would make it happy for everybody so that nobody has to be pushed out of the community? That's ultimately, I think, what we're both trying to sort of get at here.
That is, I mean, you know my heart. That's really where I want to go. That's so tough because you're right. If we bring in these consumers, we want to bring in, if we attract all this tourism and stuff, and we bring in these fantastic businesses that those folks deserve, because part of it is that we have the food and retail deserts, we don't have quality goods and services in the black community, and those folks deserve better, then you're right, we get to the problem of the higher prices and all that stuff. And it's I would depend on government investment to cure for that, to subsidize. For that, I would hope that we could find some business owners, and this is part of what we talked about. Some of these guys are really, really rich. There's a part of Bronzeville that, you know, there's these mansions there.
Yeah, yeah.
They're willing to subsidize that and keep, you know, kind of normalize for that kind of stuff, and maybe just offer that fantastic, you know, that coffee shop and Jordan's Closet, the children's clothing store, they did have really great prices, and for some reason that model worked for them. So we just need to find those businesses that, you know, maybe through the supply chain can still offer decent goods at value prices without having to charge so much more, and making sure those prices don't go up because the demographics in the community change. Jocelyn had a great model, and she was making money and still selling stuff cheap. We need to make sure that we have businesses like Jocelyn in Bronzeville. Now we're not gonna have antique shops and some of the stuff that we have here in some of the businesses that are gonna be there are not gonna be the same kind of businesses we have in Oak Park.
Mm-hmm.
But can focus on those businesses where to get the supplies they need, the labor they need, they can still have local price points that won't dishonor or place the folks who are there.
Sure.
Again, perfect answer, but at least worthy of research and you know, we can recruit you to the Beacon Board so that you can keep challenging us this way and stop making us feel that we can feel good our way into these answers to this tough question.
Well, one last question, because I know you got a jam, but the thing that fascinated me was that the original name for the empowerment experiment was the Ebony Experiment, and you were threatened with legal action by Ebony Magazine, which I had no idea. So you have the world's, probably, you know, this nation's most foremost black publication threatening you, finding the name to be problematic. I mean, if that's the problem, what does this say about how we think in terms of race and economics, and also images of discussing race.
Right. You have to know. I mean, you also know that the most painful part of this experiment, besides, you know, these issues are painful, but the most painful thing was my mom.
Yeah.
Besides my mom.
Sure.
This thing with Ebony, I mean, still makes me cry right now. My
yeah.
eyes are welling up thinking about that.
Yeah.
That we had. You know, there's some history there that Ebony knew about our experiment way before we even launched. And we were talking about coverage and sponsoring and partnering and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, we get our big media break with MSNBC, and all of a sudden there's an issue with the name, which is just so heartbreaking on so many levels. Because number one, we really went into this thinking that Johnson Publications, from everyone within Johnson Publications, especially someone like Linda Johnson Rice, would support this wholeheartedly. Maybe that's just us being naive, but we did not think a black business that was created and sustained black consumer dollars would ever do anything that might hurt this experiment. If anything, thought that they would sponsor it.
Yeah.
So
or at least open up a dialogue or something.
Right. It hurt because they did not support us, and we're just so disappointed because we thought they would. But then it went to the whole thing. It's like, if I can't depend on Ebony, why are we even doing this?
Yeah.
Really, why are we doing this if we can't get Ebony to at least leave us alone, to not try to shut us down? And it's just so a perfect example of, remember the whole thing that we talked about with the PBS?
Yeah.
That the folks who already got it, this thing that we have in our community, is prevalent in the black community. It's like, look, I already got one. I'm Ebony. I do not have the responsibility to help your poor little fledgling little community service project get going, even though the message of it supports everything that it got us to where we are. Even though you're right here in Chicago, even though, I mean, all of that stuff. And I'll tell you one last thing, and nobody knows this, because you've been so nice to me today, and I think I can trust you.
Uh-huh.
I've had interactions with Linda Johnson Rice since then. And before I go into any more, I must say, we still subscribe to Ebony.
Yeah.
I love Ebony as an institution. I've never and will never, even though people have prodded me to do it, tell people not to subscribe, not to support, not all that stuff. My problem was with her, Linda Johnson Rice.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, we were both honored by my business school, University of Chicago Booth Graduate School of Business. They had an event where they honored black business people. I gave the keynote and was given the big, I forget what the award was. And she was one of the honorees for businesses. She was very nice. Very gracious, acted like nothing happened, and there were a lot of cameras there, so I had to do the same. And she made a promise that Ebony would be covering the empowerment experiment moving forward.
Yeah. Was this a turf war? Is that really what this is all about? That there are competing notions of, well, we are basically defining the dialogue. We determine how we talk about race, and we are the standard. Was it something along those lines? Did you experience this with anybody else? It makes me wonder, like, what Bill Cosby would have to say about the empowerment experiment, you know?
You know, it's funny. I would think that Bill Cosby would be happy about it, because he's really into the whole bootstrapping.
Yeah.
For us, just, you know, kind of being more accountable for our own problems. So that, I mean, and just to the extent that we're not saying, let's go to the government and blaming other people, and let's say, you know, let's just do something about our situation, I think that he would support it. But one of the terms that kind of stirs up in me when I think about what happened with that is hateration.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you're bringing out there, that, you know, and folks say it to me when we talk, those folks close to me who know the ins and outs of what happened, that could there have been a thing that, you know, that we are leaders now in this discussion.
Yeah.
That when people think about buying black, self-help economics, supporting black businesses, reinvesting our wealth, they do see my family. They do think about this experiment. If you Google it, you are going to find us at least in the first top five things. And you probably aren't going to see anything that Ebony has done. I'm not going to say that that was the driving force, but I would say that that might have something to do with the attack. That they did probably see the propensity for this to kind of control that whole discussion.
SEO was a threat.
But most of me thinks that, you know, it was really about her bowing down to the possibility that some of her sponsors wouldn't understand the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurts the most, because I think that she should have defended us.
Yeah.
And because, you know, we've survived up to this point, dozens of well-meaning or not, major corporations have invited me to come speak, talk about this issue, talk about more supplier diversity. I don't think that in the mainstream media, universities, or in corporate America, we're being vilified as these racists trying to take down anybody. And I think that it should have given us a chance and maybe just stood up for us a little bit if that was the issue, her possibly losing some advertisers. That's disappointing that her gut reaction wouldn't be to defend us. And I'm thinking that's more of what had to do with it. Maybe some of what we discussed before, this kind of hateration kind of thing.
Got it. Well, Maggie, there's lots of stuff to chew on here. I have to have you back. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much. It was great to have you. So,
gotta just keep on rolling, keep on rolling. I'm talking, I'm talking. Boy, moving fast. And I'm hoping, and I'm praying that I don't crash. All I know is I'm not slowing, I'm not slowing. Gotta just keep on rolling. Gotta keep on, gotta stay focused, stay focused. Young boy, move, we rollin', and they rollin'. I'm rollin', we rollin'. All I know is I'm not rollin', rollin', we rollin'. Gotta just keep on rollin', rollin', gotta keep on. Put it there once, I'ma let my knife fill up the plug. Let me light my blunt. And I don't really know what the fuck's in my cup, but a couple shots.